With us now are our regular political observers, David Brooks of the New York Times and E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you,
Mayor.
And I'd like to run past you again what Speaker Pelosi said. Quote, "The passage of this legislation will send a change, signal a change of direction in Iraq that will end the fighting." What do you think? Will it, David?
No, it's certainly one of the fighting between the Sunni and Shia, and it probably one of the fighting, if we withdraw, between the Iranians and the Saudis. It'll expand the fighting. And that's sort of been my frustration through this whole debate. I'd like to see some Democrat who either wants to keep the current levels of troops, the Rumsfeld levels, as I like to call them, or get out entirely. What's next? The intelligence community thinks that what's next is disaster. So I'd like to see some Democrat grapple with that reality. And in this debate, I went up to the Hill and watched the debate. No one grappled with that reality. It was a series of talking points repeating things that could have been said a year or two ago.
You don't return inspired from the Hill, from what you heard.
Like, depressed.
E.J. Dionne, what do you think? The passage of the non-binding resolution will signal a change of direction in Iraq that will end the fighting.
Yeah, I think it's going to begin a process. I think what you saw with the Baker-Hamilton report is a position that pointed the way out slowly. A lot of Democrats have embraced versions of the Baker-Hamilton report. You also have people like Joe Biden, who's had his plan for federalism or a kind of partition for a long time. And I thought this was a very significant vote. You had 17 Republicans defect, a little less than Democrats thought. They thought 20 to 25. But only two Democrats voted against the party position. And I was thinking back to 2002, 2003, 2004. Those numbers would have been reversed. And I think that's a sign of where
the Republicans were more solid at that time.
At that time, and Democrats would have defected. Yeah. And it was also striking in this debate that Republicans did not want to debate the surge. Indeed, a memo went around saying, if we debate the surge, we lose. And so instead, they tried to move the debate to almost anything else. Essentially, if you vote for this resolution, it's a sign of weakness, retreat, it's bad for the troops. I think the last thing you saw today, and it was very striking, almost as soon as this resolution passed the House, Senator Dick Durbin of the Democratic whip got up on the Senate floor, read the House resolution into the Senate record, and said, why can't we vote on this? He's using the House as a lever against the Senate Republicans. And what you got is discipline with the Democrats in each House trying to help each other. Discipline and Democrat don't usually appear together except on the D page of a short dictionary.
David, EJ's a lot more impressed with what's happened than you are.
Well, I just think as a matter of debate, it was just a series of talking points. And as a matter of grappling with the reality of what's happening in this week, the quiescence of the Mahdi army, the policing of the health ministries, a lot of interesting things are going on. None of that had anything to do with it. But I do think this is a warm-up. It's a warm-up for what could be a constitutional crisis over the next couple of weeks as we get into a real debate where Congress and some Democrats in Congress, led by Jack Murtha, want to put conditions on the funding.
On funding.
And then
for the
it's
war,
not
yeah.
just symbolic. Then we're actually talking about Congress managing the war or helping to manage the war. And the question is, will they actually take a stand and say, we want this policy to prevail? We take responsibility for this policy.
Let's look beyond the Congress and this administration and how the issue of Iraq appears to you to be shaping up in the presidential debate for 2008. EJ first. Right now, for a Democrat to be viable, must the Democrat be somebody who at least opposes the surge or at least recants a prior vote or at least opposes funding of the war?
Right. In some ways, as my friend Harold Meyerson wrote, this is starting to resemble 1972, where even when George McGovern took the strong anti-war stance, won the Democratic nomination, and even Democrats like Ed Muskie, who had originally supported the war but had turned against it, weren't good enough. And I think Hillary Clinton's position is a little bit like Ed Muskie's, where Democrats want her to apologize for her past vote. Now, David wrote a very interesting column suggesting that if you read what she actually said at the time, she doesn't have much to apologize for. But Democrats want strong signals from all these candidates that they really are against this war. On the Republican side, it's not clear yet. What's intriguing is that John McCain has been falling in the polls. Rudy Giuliani has a commanding position. He went on Larry King and he continued to support the president, but he said an awful lot of critical things about the way the war was managed. So you wonder if you're going to see more ferment on the Republican side.
David, let's hear from you on both the Republicans and the Democrats and Iraq as an issue for 2008.
Yeah, it's not structuring the Republican race because I think all the major Republican candidates say as long as we have a chance of getting a less bad option, we have to continue. So I think they're all pretty much close to each other. It is, as EJ suggested, structuring the Democratic race, and the pressure is on Hillary Clinton. And, you know, I went back and I looked at the speeches she gave in 2002 and 2003. She explicitly rejected a unilateral action. She explicitly rejected a preemptive war. She wanted to, you know, go to the UN and have more inspections, et cetera, et cetera. And it strikes me she's being absolutely honest when she says if she'd been president, there wouldn't have been a war. And so, A, I don't think on substantive grounds, she was not like I was, a hawkish war supporter. I don't think she should apologize. And just politically now, if she apologized now, it would be pure pandering. And I think would really destroy her.
I agree with David. She can't get out of this box now by apologizing. She's taken this firm position. She's just got to reproduce David's column about a million times and try to persuade people in the party who are against the war that she's actually being quite consistent and never liked the way Bush did things.
Let the record show that this week a governor actually did apologize. Ed Rendell apologized to the people of Pennsylvania for there being a 50-mile backup on Route I-78 for 24 hours, and it was a full-blooded apology for a complete failure of communication. So once in a while, that does happen.
A great apology from a politician this week who apologized for the pain he caused himself, which was a great apology.
Well, thanks to both of you, David Brooks of the New York Times and E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution.
Thank you. Without apology.